I think we might start. Welcome to concurrent session 1E, titled Solvency II Latest Developments. My name is Martin Paino, and I'll be the chair for this session. Today's presenter is Craig McCulloch from KPMG Actuaries. Craig started his career with 6 years at the UK life insurer Standard Life, working in a variety of actuarial roles. He then spent 3 years at Barry and Hibbett, a specialist UK-based actuarial risk and capital management consultancy, before moving to KPMG Actuaries in Australia in 2007. Craig,
it does.
Craig specialises in providing advice on risk-based economic capital models, capital and investment risk management, and the use of derivative instruments. Some of you might be aware, Craig authored the paper titled ALM in a Solvency II World. That was the winner of the Melville Financial Services Prize at the Financial Services Forum in 2008. Before I hand over to Craig, a couple of housekeeping points. Craig will present for around about 30 minutes, and then we'll have around 10 minutes for questions. Also, please keep any questions or comments to a maximum of 2 minutes. So, over to you, Craig.
Thank you, Martin. It's good to see a lot of people here. Apologies if there's a lack of seating. Clearly, the risk management and the convention numbers hasn't been quite what it should be for this first session. But thanks again for coming along. I have a lot of material to try and get through here, so I'm going to run through this quite quickly. So apologies if I skirt over some details. Essentially, Solvency II has been a very slow-moving beast for the last however long it's been now, the best part of a decade and coming to fruition. I'm going to keep you up to speed on what's really been happening over the last year or so. As with all these things in kind of a European parliamentary or regulatory sense, not very much happens for quite a long period of time, and then you submit your slides, and then 2 days later there are finally acceptance of directives and so on actually moving there. So some of this might be slightly out of date. I'll keep you up to speed on that as we go. In terms of a brief agenda, I will give you a two-minute overview of what Solvency II actually looks like. I'm really assuming here that people are already aware of the basic concept behind Solvency II, so I'll try and keep that to a minimum. And then the bulk of the time I'll talk about the latest developments which are in there. So a little bit about the timetable and the progress of Solvency II as it finally moves towards becoming a reality. A little bit about implementation measures and how that fits in with the overall regulatory structure in Europe, which is slightly complex. And then some results and implications from the last of the quantitative studies that was held, the results of which came out in November of last year. And then I'll just have a very brief slide on what I think it means for Australian firms and actuaries, and a brief point of summary. We'll come with questions at the end. Hopefully we'll have lots of time and can get a little bit of debate and discussion going. So first up, a brief overview of what Solvency II actually looks like. This should look nice and familiar. Solvency II is essentially Europe's attempt to move to a risk-based capital system of regulation, which is a three-pillar-based structure or overall framework, which essentially is intended to apply to all European insurers, whether general insurers, life insurers, health insurers, reinsurers, and so on. The first pillar is the set of quantitative requirements, essentially the rules which set out how much capital firms actually have to hold. And the second and third pillars sort of move on from that and try and attempt essentially to embed more of an enterprise risk management type framework in the European regulatory structure. So in particular, pillar two is all around governance of an insurer and the structures that need to be in place there, whereas pillar three touches on disclosure requirements. In terms of latest developments, it's probably worth saying right now, pillar one is where most of the development has gone on here today. And it really does remain to be seen particularly what pillar three will look like, although that's perhaps of less interest to us as actuaries. Pillar two, there are some details and some frameworks which I'll come on to later, but again, an awful lot of work still to be done on implementation. Now, in terms of that first pillar and the capital requirements for firms, essentially there's two broad levels of capital that firms have to hold. There's a minimum capital requirement, which is essentially the point of regulatory intervention, at which point the regulators will essentially come in and take over the running of a firm and so on. Now, that is intended to be a simple standard formula type approach, calibrated to a one-year 85% confidence level. So essentially an 85% chance of being able to meet a mark-to-market type measure of liabilities. The SCR is the higher level of capital requirement, and that can be set in one of two ways, either using some standard formulae, which are intended to be calibrated to a 99.5% confidence level over 1 year, or some internal models, and we'll come back to that as we cover the rest of the session. Capital can be covered by a concept of multiple tiers of eligible capital. So there's a notion of some types of capital being better or more valuable than other types of capital. In terms of the basic structure, the basic framework is that a market-consistent balance sheet is used as the starting point to derive capital requirements. So essentially, firms are required to put a base market-consistent valuation on both assets and liabilities. And for those liabilities, the technical provisions, the liability component of that balance sheet, is measured on a best estimate basis, plus, for non-hedgeable risks, a risk margin. Now, I'm not really going to touch on it here, but the way it looks as if that risk margin is going to be calculated is using a cost of capital approach, which is the method that's been tested throughout the various quantitative tests that have happened recently. Capital is essentially calculated by applying a number of stresses in various different risk categories to that market-consistent balance sheet. So under the standard formulaic rules, essentially you apply that stress to a number of individual risk drivers. You should be able to just about make this out. And those are categorised into various groupings, so life risks or general insurance, non-life risks, market risks and so on. And within each grouping, those capital requirements are then correlated using a rather simple approach, which you'll be pleased to hear from this morning's session assumes lots of normality and linear correlation matrices to combine those risks together. And then up at that higher level, the aggregate risks for firms are then again combined together using some simple correlation matrices to come up with some basic capital requirement. There's also an operational risk capital requirement in there as well. And the approach here is to essentially assume that that capital requirement has a correlation of one with all other risks. In other words, you just add those capital requirements together. And that is where you end up with your total capital requirement. So that's, in a nutshell, the quantitative part of Solvency II. Now, as far as the legislative timetable goes and the current regulatory progress, I thought I'd just flick up a quick timeline for you in terms of how Solvency II has been progressing. Now, as you can see, this timeline clearly isn't very linear, and that March is after April. This, again, is a function of the fact that it's a very slow pace of development and then things happen quickly. Over the last 4 months or so, there's been a fairly protracted and heated debate amongst the various European regulatory setting bodies, if you like. And in particular, there are in European legislative circles, there's essentially three different layers of legislators who debate and set these sorts of financial regulations. I saw this referred to recently, or the ongoing debate between these three entities as a trialogue, which I thought was a wonderful invention to the English language, which I'll certainly use again. So you've got three levels there. You've got the European Commission, you've got the European Parliament, and then you've got the ECOFIN, which is essentially the grouping of European finance ministers. And these three bodies have certainly been putting their heads together and trying to come up with an agreement as to the overall piece of legislative framework, the Solvency II Framework Directive. Now, that's been a fairly heated debate, and eventually, as at the end of March, agreement was reached as to what the Framework Directive will actually look like. So there's a couple of points which I'll touch on as to changes that have happened there over the last year, but essentially that overall framework has been carried through largely in line with the most recent proposals which have been on the cards for the last couple of years. Now, alongside that, and that directive is going to be voted on relatively shortly, I think within the next 2 days, to actually embed it into European law. Alongside that, implementing measures have to be adopted. So essentially there's the overall framework, and then there's some sort of more detailed implementation measures, and then there's another level of more detailed implementation guidance that attaches to it. Those second level, those second tier implementation measures are essentially now where the debate moves to. So the practical details that go out with the realms of the regulation. Almost as soon as it was agreed that ECOFIN and the Commission and the Parliament had come to some sort of agreement, CEOPS, which is the Association of European essentially Insurance Supervisors, published another 12 consultation papers on the Level 2 implementation measures. I could bore you to tears with details of all 12 of those, but suffice to say those are at a pretty early stage in terms of working out some of the details about, you know, things like what are the mechanics behind some of the technical provision calculations and so on. Looks as if there's going to be another quantitative impact study at some point next year, largely to calibrate and set up some of those implementation measures. And then finally, that should result in some formal guidance, some formal implementation measures which have to be adopted. And then finally, 18 months after that, Solvency II actually comes about. So even now, it still looks like a fairly long process. But as we'll see as we go through here, that long process is really quite a short timeline when it comes to the amount of effort that European insurers are actually going to have to put in right now. Now, in terms of this ongoing recent debate, there's a couple of key elements which have been the source of some fairly protracted discussions. And there's two things which I'm going to focus on here just to give you a flavour for this. The first of these is an allowance for what's been termed as group support. And the other is the issue of pro-cyclicality particularly around equity market shocks and the amount of capital firms have to hold against taking equity risks. Now, this is nice and topical given some of the discussion we've just seen around, for instance, Basel II and the extent to which capital requirements there are pro-cyclical. The debate in Europe around Solvency II has largely been fostered around some of these notions, and one could say a bit of a reaction to everything that's happened in the GFC recently. So in terms of group support, what actually is group support? The previous draft of Solvency II included essentially these provisions to allow group support. Now, this was essentially Solvency II's way of allowing for the fact that insurance groups potentially have some significant diversification benefits across the entire group, and those benefits should, in theory, lead to lower capital requirements. Now, the way that was framed in the original draft of Solvency II was that individual operating entities could make use of this thing called group support. And the way this actually happened was essentially a subsidiary of a larger insurance organisation, so for instance a subsidiary in any particular country, could essentially take credit for an element of group support in terms of the capital. Or in other words, that firm could recognise that there was free unallocated capital elsewhere within the group and then use that capital to go and meet their solvency requirements locally. So you have here with Solvency II 27 different member states and 27 different local regulators, each one trying to regulate their individual entities. This was the attempt to essentially allow for that wider embedding of group diversification features within each of the individual operating entities. Now, the point about group support was that it was aimed at being a lower quality of capital than other types of capital. So you could only use it to cover capital in excess, or capital requirements in excess of the minimum capital requirement, and it would be a lower tier of capital than other forms, which mean that you can only use a certain proportion of those to meet those individual capital requirements. What happened back in December was that the Council of Finance Ministers essentially removed that group support element. Now, it is worth understanding just a little bit about the politics to just understand why that has happened. there's almost universal support for these type of group support regimes across Europe. We'll come back to the procyclicality element in a second, but essentially the removal of the group support provision was a compromise agreement in those political discussions, which was largely thrown in there, as far as I can see, to provide some sort of incentive for the smaller nations, who certainly feared that, given wider control over groups, individual insurance entities in Europe, and particular regulators of smaller of smaller countries, risk losing some control over the capital direction and regulation of those individual entities. So that control would be ceded towards the larger entities. And the removal of group support has largely gone ahead because of some fears that that might happen. Sitting from a or looking at this from a devil's advocate point of view, I think it's fairly easy to see that, given some of the actions that have happened over the global financial crisis, with the likes of Icelandic economy moving into free fall and some of their banks coming into quite a bit of trouble, and then having the likes of the UK essentially seize banking assets of the Icelandic banks in the UK, I think has only led to these types of provisions gaining strength and a bit of credence. As a kind of compromise to removing these things, there have been additional provisions added to attempt to allow for better cross-border supervision. So essentially a broader college of supervisors, which will have some sort of oversight role of insurance groups across Europe. It's not clear yet quite what that role will actually involve or how that will actually materialise. Now, in terms of group support, one of the reasons that this was allowed to be removed, or the kind of carrot for this from the bigger companies was, or the bigger countries, was the issue of procyclicality. It's already been touched on earlier. One of the concerns, particularly from the French industry and the French regulator, was that, as it was drafted, the current Solvency II capital requirements were essentially very unconditional with regards to certain types of risk. So, in particular, equity risks, you need to hold essentially the same amount of capital for an equity fall, say a 35% fall in equity markets, regardless of what's happened recently in equity markets. Now, the concerns there were that certain industries in certain countries would essentially therefore need to de-risk following severe market risk type events, or in other words, the levels of capital requirements might become too onerous following poor events, and simply not onerous enough earlier on when markets are going great guns. Now, essentially with these discussions, what was agreed and what's actually gone into the Solvency II Framework Directive is a provision which essentially allows for an explicit capturing of part of that procyclicality element in the equity risk capital formula. So essentially what that says, and it's worded in a very vague way to allow the implementation measures to set out some of the detail, but essentially what that provision is saying is that when implementations are drafted, they can allow for a lower equity shock given a market fall over a certain previous period of time. This was actually tested as part of the quantitative study previously, and there was actually also an additional provision which appears slightly contrarian with a kind of risk hat on, which essentially says that for certain types of business, particularly long-dated occupational pension business, the extent of the risk charge that you would take for equity risk will be a function of the liability of, or the duration of your liabilities. Now that provision was fairly widely opposed, we'll come back to that later, but again it has found its way into the final version of the directive. The interesting thing that's going to be to watch here is whether or not those positions remain in there over the longer term. One of the compromises that was agreed was that this particular provision was there to be reviewed after 3 years, so this and the group support element, and it's certainly going to be interesting to see whether or not each of these two things stands the test of time. I think it's fairly safe to say that the politics and a little bit of short-term reaction to some of the events of the global financial crisis have certainly flavoured the shape of the Solvency Directive as it's now been passed. The review in 3 years' time, I think, will certainly be a good opportunity for European firms to step back and say, OK, is this actually what we intended? Given that I think some of the feedback on these measures has been less than favourable, let's just say, from the majority of the European participants. Now, implementation measures. I mentioned earlier that implementation measures are essentially the kind of second tier of development of Solvency II. And the interesting thing here is that those implementation measures essentially have to be carried out by local regulators across Europe. Now, at this early stage, as mentioned, CEOPS have only just published 12 papers on the kind of initial phase of those implementation measures. What I've done is I've essentially picked up on a discussion paper from one of those regulators, which you may not be surprised to hear from my accent that that's the UK regulator. Apologies for not going into detail on any of the other 26 local regulators, but my Slovenian just wasn't quite up to it. Essentially, the UK released, or the FSA in the UK released this discussion paper back in November. And the intention of the discussion paper is really just to bring about a greater level of clarity and essentially to bring forward some of the implementation discussion and thoughts within the industry ahead of the legislature actually making moves and actually setting some of this guidance, which has been a very slow process. Now, I'm not going to go through this in any great detail, and I think time constraints mean that I really have to skip over this super quick, but there's a couple of really interesting comments that the FSA raised here. So in the FSA, the use of internal models has been essentially embedded within the UK insurance industry for around about 5 years now, in terms of determining regulatory oversight and also to a certain extent capital requirements. But the FSA has come out in this paper and specifically said, look, based on what we've seen in the ICAS regime, while we think a lot of firms are going to apply for internal model approval, we don't think that the industry is yet well prepared for what Solvency II will actually require in this area. And I personally think this is quite a big wake-up call for the entire European industry, not least the UK industry. I think it's pretty clear, and we'll see this in some of the QIS numbers that we touch on in a second, that the industry, I'm just going to skip over this, the industry will be looking for internal model approval as a way of reducing capital requirements. I think that's fairly clear. But the ability of regulators to actually oversee this and provide a reasonable mechanism for doing it is going to be incredibly tight. This was a time that we probably can't read this very well. I don't think the resolution is quite good enough to do this. But essentially, the FSA set out a timetable for where it thinks firms need to be in terms of that model approval process. And essentially, what it boils down to is firms have to be taking action right now, according to the FSA, if they want to start gaining approval for internal models for the start of Solvency II. So in particular, firms have to be nominating senior members of staff who essentially own parts of this process right now. There will be essentially an initial period of a dry run, running of internal models and regulatory oversight of that, which the FSA will, during the course of that, essentially develop their processes and their oversight and their supervision requirements for firms. So what essentially that means is that as far as I can see, the entire European industry has to really be moving on this now. If firms want to be using internal models, which they will, then this just has to move incredibly quickly. Now, one of the other things that was highlighted, and I'll touch on this very briefly, were some of the Pillar 2 requirements in the Solvency Framework Directive. Now, again, there aren't an awful lot of details here yet as to what those Pillar 2 requirements will actually be. But one of the key things that the FSA paper specifically picks up on is the fact that there are these two very specific things that the Solvency Framework Directive requires firms to do. One is to have an effective risk management system. What effective means, I guess, is yet to be decided, but essentially that part puts very specific requirements on all insurers to have, for instance, actuarial functions, risk management functions, internal audit functions, which I think for some firms will certainly be a step beyond their existing structure. The second element, and I think personally that this is really the crux of Solvency II, is that firms have to have in place this notion of an own risk insolvency assessment. Now, that own risk insolvency assessment is essentially a firm's internal assessment, given its own risk appetite, of the amount of capital it needs to run its business. And the key thing which the discussion paper picks up on is that that really has to be an integral part of the management of the business, and in particular, firms are going to have to demonstrate, if they want to use things like internal models, that those internal models have been captured into that own risk solvency assessment, essentially that firm's own embedded ERM type process in there. What that will actually look like, I think, it still has a long way to go, but it's pretty clear to me at this stage that that's going to be where an awful lot of the next 2 years' worth of movement by European life industry, European general insurance industry, will actually be required. So yeah, just as a really brief summary, I do think that the discussion paper there is less of a discussion paper and more of a wake-up call for the UK insurance industry. Then lastly, what I just want to touch on briefly are just some results and implications of the quantitative studies that have gone on in Europe. Essentially, these were studies aimed at benchmarking the most recent calibration and set of rules that firms need to use for Solvency II. I've got very little time to do this, but you can certainly see all of these results in the slides that we come over later. There are a few things that I do just want to flag up, which I think are quite interesting. One of the key results there of that study, which included 1,400 participants who actually filled in the quantitative part of this study, was that 11% of those would not actually be able to meet the solvency capital requirement under the QIS4 standards. Now, I think this is probably quite a big challenge in two areas. One in terms of how the final solvency standard is actually calibrated. Will the insurance industry demand that the calibration is essentially made easier or less onerous on firms? But also, I suspect that there's a fair amount of capital allocation across the industry and movement of capital that's going to need to be done for the aggregate insurance industry in Europe to be comfortable as and when Solvency II actually bites. Perhaps even more interesting and rather alarming is that just over 1% of the participants wouldn't actually be able to meet the lowest level of capital requirement under Solvency II. In terms of those capital requirements, I mentioned earlier that the minimum capital requirement is intended to be a relatively simple calculation. The way this was actually set up is that under QIS4, and this is the way the final framework has been drafted, that calculation is actually a relatively simple linear function of some fairly basic risk indicators. So things like technical provisions, the size of written premiums and so on. Very similar to the current non-risk-based type capital formula that are in place in Europe at the moment. Now, under the Solvency II test, there's a cap and floor of between 20 and 50% of the more onerous capital requirement, the solvency capital requirement for this MCR. And what actually happened is a very significant proportion of those calculations were actually caught up by that cap and floor for Solvency II. The way the QIS4 report from CEOPS put this was that they felt that an awful lot more work needed to be done to make the calibration of the minimum capital requirement reasonable, because being caught up by the cap and floor just meant that capital requirement wasn't nearly risk sensitive enough. It was good to see that the framework directive actually took account of some of this. They retained the cap and the floor, but they actually made the range narrower. So that's actually prescribed in the framework directive, and instead of being a 20 to 50% range, it's now 25 to 45%. Which means even more of those capital requirements will be caught up by the cap and the floor. So it's going to be interesting to see how that one is actually calibrated as we actually go through. I'll skip that last previous slide. In terms of calibration, there's lots of calibration issues have come out of QIS4. Key ones up there, just going to touch on a couple of these. First off, the cost of capital method set a cost of capital rate of 6% for firms. I think the more recent research, and there's been a few papers out on this, seems to suggest that a rate closer to 2.5%, 4%, 4.5%, that sort of range is more likely to be adopted. I think there's certainly work needs to be done there in Solvency II to do that calibration. The feedback from QIS4 was pretty overwhelmingly that the equity shock was just too low. Again, how consistent that is with the final calibration and these pro-cyclicality provisions, which will essentially allow the potential for a lower shock in certain scenarios, remains to be seen. And there was some general grumbling about the fact that correlations of 100% between op risks and other risks was potentially penal. I'll not touch on internal models. Groups is an interesting one. The group provisions were removed here, and essentially the group support is now gone. The findings from QIS4 were essentially that group support was actually being used in a very limited way across the insurance groups in Europe. So firms that responded to QIS4 essentially found that they didn't really use an awful lot of group support at all. Something like about 2% of the total capital across the industry was group support capital. So the removal of that provision may have a relatively limited impact on firms going forward. I'll wrap up just with where I think this might actually move in terms of QIS4. Again, this is subjective and it remains to be seen what might actually happen, but certainly equity stresses I think will need to be made tougher as a base case, given the rather overwhelming feedback that's come from firms. The fact that certain economies within the Eurozone have seen minus 70% equity returns over the last year suggests to me that a 32% capital requirement on equity is not really going to do the job there going forward. The pro-cyclicality comments have certainly already been captured within the revised framework. How the MCR finally gets calculated is going to be a key development there as well. A couple of very quick slides just to wrap up, and apologies for running over here. What might the implications be for Australian firms? This is where I'm really interested in finding out your views on how you think Solvency II might impact. I guess there's a couple of things. Clearly, various people in the industry here have, or various firms have parents who are in the EU. Now, there's no direct Solvency II requirement for capital requirements to be done for Australian subsidiaries, but I think there's every likelihood that firms in the EU will want to look at capital on a group-wide basis across all of their operations. Invariably, that does mean some work. I think in a broader context, certainly the developments on internal models and internal model approval and some of the pro-cyclicality movements in terms of some of the capital requirements there will be looking or will be watched very closely here in terms of the regulatory environment. Certainly some recent comments by APRA have suggested that they will be monitoring that situation pretty closely. And I think the requirement to hold specific capital against operational risks is one which at the moment is fairly implicit within the current Australian regulatory regime. I suspect that is one area where there certainly will be close observation of what's actually happening. I'll not run through that summary of conclusions, but certainly I'd just like to throw open the floor to comments and discussion. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone have a question or a comment they'd like to make?
Sorry.
Yeah, you should use the microphone.
There's a microphone here.
Craig, Mark Schneider. Just wanted to check, obviously the time frame's quite tight for 2012. For companies that choose not to go the internal model route by 2012, can they choose to do so, say, in 2013 or 14?
Yes. One of the issues that the likes of the FSA's discussion paper raised is that essentially, the legislation is framed so that firms have 6 months from submitting a complete approval or a complete application to having a decision made on whether or not they can use an internal model. So the process here is that the internal model has to be pre-approved by the regulator before it can be used. Now, the issue that the likes of the UK regulator has certainly stumbled upon is the fact that 6 months is nowhere near long enough for them to gain comfort. So the process is likely to be something like a 3-year process of submitting some initial applications and having discussions, dry running models for a couple of years, and then moving on. So, certainly that decision can be taken at any time and will be taken at any time. But firms are almost certainly going to be cognizant of the fact that 6 months is not the genuine approval time. It's going to be closer to 3 years, I would guess. And certainly the experience of model approval in Australia for general insurers would certainly reflect that. And I'd be interested to hear if there's any APRA comment in the room anywhere on what that process looks like, because that certainly has been a process which has been very involved, and I guess 2-3 years is a very realistic estimate of what regulators will need to gain enough comfort for those models.
Richard? Just use it.
The intention has always been that the base market consistent balance sheet is super consistent with IFRS 2. The bigger issue there has been that Solvency 2 has had to essentially be there ahead of the implementation of any of these IFRS developments. And my guess is that there may well be levels of detail where there will be inconsistencies, just purely because of timing and because of developments. But certainly the intention and the current basic structure looks as if it should be nice and consistent, which hopefully means less work for you as a subsidiary of a large European insurer and looking at these issues.
Hi, Craig, thanks for that.
Is that microphone on?
I think it is.
Hello. With captives, what about Australian captives, Australian organisations located in Europe? What happens with those?
Again, if that captive is domiciled in a European country which was covered by Solvency II, then they will certainly be required to carry out Solvency II calculations and hold capital on that basis. If that is, I'm not quite sure the structure you had in mind here, but you know, if that's an overseas captive which is belongs to a subsidiary of a firm which is based in Europe, then directly Solvency II wouldn't necessarily apply. It would just be outside the jurisdiction, and local regulators, whether those are Australian or whatever, would need to pick them up. Again, my guess is that those larger insurance groups will require work to consider things on the broader Solvency II type structure for those firms which are domiciled out with the EU region, purely for consistency.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more question down the back. Could you just use the microphone, please?
Just in relation to the
yep.
Just in relation to the charge against equity, the 32%, in the context that if you have any charge of less than 100%, then you can never have 100% level of sufficiency, and that equity is a fairly fundamental investment vehicle for general insurers, I was just curious if you could elaborate on why there's a kind of push to raise that, particularly given the effects that will have on the minimum capital requirement or the equivalent.
It's interesting, the push to raise that really came in the feedback from QIS4 from the industry and regulators. So the QIS process, I had no time to go through this in any detail, but the QIS process essentially sought quantitative and qualitative feedback from both regulators and the industry. And certainly what came out of that from CEOPS when they analysed all of these findings was that almost all regulators and member firms just felt that 32% was too low for a 1 year 99.5% probability of confidence, given where firms are already looking at internal capital requirements and the amount of capital they think they should be holding against these types of risks. So yeah, it might be slightly perverse, but I think the industry probably is driving higher capital requirements when it comes to those types of risks.
Okay, unfortunately I think we've run out of time for more questions. I'm sure you'll agree with me, Craig's presentation's been very informative, so please join with me in thanking Craig.